Today's drink sponsor is Liquid Death. Murder your thirst. It is mountain water, but the kind that murders your thirst. And it is a great tall boy can of water. Great tasting water, I might add. You can find it at Whole Foods. You can find it at grocery stores in your area, as well as liquiddeath.com and on Amazon. Today's episode is with Dylan Bynan. Dylan is he's the founder of a company called MindBloom, which is one of the first legal psychedelic therapy clinics in the U.S. And we talk a little bit about that, but it's a deep dive episode on psychedelic therapies for the last 10 years and into the next 10 years. It is a world which is, within certain circles, a lot of people have had much enthusiasm about the results and the research for psychedelics for mental health issues, and especially in comparison to conventional treatment options that have been out there for the last 20, 25 years, but haven't changed much in the last two decades. And that's starting to change. The dialogue has preceded it, and now there actually are therapies like MindBloom, that, which is almost unthinkable to put together, or would have been unthinkable 5 years ago. It's really interesting that even that today, in December and 2020, you can order psychedelics that are delivered to your house that you can take therapeutically for things like anxiety or depression or insomnia with the guidance of doctors telemedically through a company like MindBloom. It's a fascinating conversation, and I knew it would be with a guest like Dylan. So without further ado, let's get into it with Dylan Bynan. This is Below the Line. Three, two, one, and we're live. Dylan, welcome to Below the Line.
Thanks, James. Pumped to chat.
Where are you right now?
I just completed a cross-country move from a decade in Manhattan, in Chinatown specifically, to Austin, Texas. So I'm in my close friend and investor Justin Mayer's office in Austin, Texas. Yeah.
That's awesome. I was in Austin before San Francisco, and then just moved to LA like 5 months ago. What took you to this? I don't want to dramatize it, but it does seem like a lot of founders of my portfolio of 80 something companies, four out of six founders, and MindBloom is, I'm so thankful to be an investor in MindBloom. So that would make it actually five out of six founders from New York moving from New York to, four of them have come to LA. And one to Austin. I want to get into psychedelics, but I do want to just cover what the thought process was behind moving from New York to Austin.
Well, I think smart, independent thinkers converge on the truth.
Yeah.
So I'm actually from Southern California originally. I went to school out east, moved back to LA for a year because I thought I couldn't deal with the East Coast. Begrudgingly came out to New York and very quickly realized I'm a New Yorker. So I love New York. As my partner in crime, who's actually our VP of engineering here at MindBloom, as we sort of painted forward our paths in life, you know, started having kids in a couple of years, we had this big ambition and dream to, I don't know if you call it like a co-living community or an anti-commune, but to live like in one area with all of our friends, where we have set up you know, systems to share a lot of meals together, raise our kids together, do like private schooling together, have a lot of shared recreational spaces together. And it seemed a lot more likely that we could pull that off in Austin, both because we have friends here and we have friends in, you know, across the country who we think could move here, than in Manhattan.
Well, I'm a born and bred Texan, so it's that is great to hear. I do love, I was in Austin before, like I said, before San Francisco. I love LA. I'd give it 11 out of 10 of anywhere I've lived, but Austin is certainly a special place. What is the that's fascinating. What is an anti-commune commune? That just sounds like what you described, sounds like a commune.
I think
yeah, in the most positive way possible.
No. It sure does. It's a problem because there's a certainly preconceived viewpoints on the word commune. I think like it reduces down to if we could buy a community, gated or otherwise, where instead of your neighbors being strangers that you hope you like, your neighbors are all your best friends. That's the best way to describe it.
Yeah, that sounds pretty amazing. I groups of friends talk about things like that as a dream. That's pretty cool that you are taking the steps to make it happen.
We're crazy.
Yeah. Describe a little bit more about your friend group, because we're all products of our environment, and what we're about to discuss with psychedelics and the very innovative early foray professionally with your career into them, way earlier than for listeners, Mind Bloom, and I'll mention in the intro as well, but one of the very first legal clinics for psychedelic therapy in the U.S. And yeah, so very innovative, independent thinking. Tell me a little bit about your friend group. I would imagine what you just said, maybe they're similar.
So my friends are probably one of the most like critical parts of my entire life. I grew up not with a ton of family, like a single working class father. And throughout my life, my friends have been, I don't know, a massive source of meaning. I think part of the mental health care crisis is actually a divorce from meaning, purpose, and connection to other people, which maybe we can get into. So I have like a wide swath of friends from friends I grew up with, some of which even work with me at Mind Bloom, friends from college. I think you've had some on your podcast, like Andrew Dudem, who's in my fraternity at UPenn.
That's great conversation with him. Such a deep thinker. We talked about exposure therapy as much as we talked about anything else. And that's very cool for a founder to talk about exposure therapy and their approach to being a CEO. That's a founder of HIMS on one of the previous podcasts. But yes, okay, go back to what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, he was building tech startups in college while I was trying to meet girls. Like he's very, very ahead of the game, pioneering. And then I have friends from going to Burning Man and music festivals, and now a large group of friends who are technology entrepreneurs and founders like you. And so I think by having friends from different walks of life and sourcing a lot of different ideas, one of the commonalities that it's all reduced down to is being really close. So propinquity, like your proximity to other people, to people that you have like a deep, meaningful connection with, is to me been one of the most like fulfilling and rewarding parts of my life. It was the impetus for moving from LA, where I actually didn't know anybody when I was living there, back to New York, even though I didn't think I wanted to live on the East Coast, was just to be near people I know really closely and love. And so that's the inspiration for trying to build a community, making some sacrifices in terms of how we might want to live or where we might want to live to really push on the vector of living really, really close to people we love.
That's cool. That's seems about as intentional as one can get when it comes to friendships. I remember reading a study that guys, males over 30, in their 20s, they have something like 8 close friends. In their 30s, they have something like 2. And the ability to meet new friends like plummets in their 30s for a whole host of reasons, growth of family, growth of career, prioritization of career. Friendship really does take a back seat. And in many ways, so many of us are driven by like this desire for, I didn't have what I wanted in the friend group when I was 16. I'm going to go out and crush it in life and I'm going to get that on the other side, and you lose the plot when you're 30, 36, 46, and you're like, wait, what was I doing? I know that I can tell you straight up, I was in many ways inspired to get into entrepreneurship and building things and doing big things in dramatic ways in a very immature mindset around this idea of connection is what I'm ultimately seeking, and didn't have that articulation, didn't have that understanding, but I was ultimately seeking connection, and it was pushing me ambition-wise to the East Coast, to South Africa, to San Francisco. It's quite ironic how much it disconnected me from people. During building companies in my 20s, I miss best friends' weddings and things because of entrepreneurship and thinking that was so important. And when I look back, I was like, fuck, that was when I was 15 or 16 or 17, when I felt just outside of where I, the epicenter of where I wanted to get into, break into, it led me 1,000 miles away from that. Actually tell me a little bit about, you mentioned the mental health and its connection to propinquity to friends. It's a cool word.
Yeah.
And meaning and purpose connection. Do you mind giving listeners background on your familiarity and relationship with mental health and mental illness?
Yeah. Before I do, I want to go back to what you just said about prioritizing your work over your connections. I think it's really fascinating. I think we've like come to accept that investing in your health needs to be a number one, non-negotiable top priority because it's such an input to everything else you do. It's like obvious to us now. We've accepted that, even if we probably didn't like the 70s. I think right now we're going through this transition where people are beginning to accept, and we're still in point, maybe the second inning of it, that your mental health and well-being is a non-negotiable top priority that should come before everything else, and it's an input to everything else. I know that's something you're a big fan of. I think you talk about like mental wealth. Mm-hmm. I think maybe another 10 years, and we're not even close there, is really accepting that your social life, your relationships with other people needs to be a non-negotiable top priority. That's an input into everything else. And when you look at those studies that you mentioned, you see that when you control for extroverts, socioeconomic status, it doesn't matter. People get really lonely when they get older and they lose those connections. And the correlation between a degrading health of like cardiovascular, neurodegenerative is tremendous when people don't have close connections with at least like one or two friends.
Right. Right. It's, yeah, there's, I feel like there is so much work we need to do collectively, societally, with how we talk about not just prioritize, but also talk about mental health and yeah, mental wealth is, for listeners, you can Google mental wealth for an essay I wrote on part of what you just mentioned of, we talk about mental health as a synonym to mental illness and we don't talk about physical health as a synonym to physical illness. Physical health is something that now, you know, 50 years ago we didn't, but now we actively encourage everyone to invest in it. And like you'd invest in anything else, you know, a 401k, you're playing the stock market, a new career, a new hobby, you invest in it, and we should be investing in our mental health. So I couldn't be more on board. I love that you're going even further to talk about the social connections, because it really does feel like that is this, there's nothing, I can't imagine any better articulation of what we should all be striving for is a long life of laughter. And that would be an amazing life if you had 50 years of just laughter with people you know and love, and as you know, an ideal to seek. But that is so far from the 32-year-old me that's just crunching away at a job, at a creation, at a company, and knowing on the other side, what is the rap phrase? You work a little to ball a lot, and it's like you that's the investment so that you can ball a lot. But somewhere along the way, you lose the plot and you forget that's what it's about, and then you hit the cliche 42-year-old kind of midlife crisis of like, fuck, I kind of played this hand a little bit wrong.
I think your point on laughter is fascinating. I've been thinking a lot and practicing that in like a remote work world where you don't have those frequent interactions with other people where you're laughing as like a source of bonding. I've been spending more time like watching like stand-up comedy because I find out like I'm not laughing as much. And that has been like a massive lift on my mood. And yeah, you know, the reason that stand-up comedy or anything else really works is because I think we haven't like evolved in like 100, 200,000 years. So we still have this like ancient brains and bodies in this modern world. And so we can't like really distinguish that what we see on TV or like pornography or anything else we're interacting with on our computer screen isn't real. Like we think right. It's real because we translate these like light and pixels and colors and sounds into reality. So I think you can hack getting some social connection, you know, through something like that.
Yeah.
Although that's probably, you know, needs to be a light prescription, not a, not right. A complete substitute.
Yeah, exactly. Oh man, that's so interesting around mentioning stand-up. I also love stand-up comedy. In fact, my producer, Nick, he's the producer, my favorite comedian in the world, this guy, Theo Vaughn, his podcast. And it is such great entertainment. I remember someone telling me entertainment, the etymology of the word entertain is to maintain presence. the best entertainers, it's almost meditative. They can maintain your presence, you know, externally.
Lose yourself.
Lose yourself. Exactly. You laugh, and laughing specifically, Theo talks about this. Laughing is this thing. It's like God pulls it out of you. It's this uncontrollable thing that you love that could happen in any moment if you surround yourself with the right people, maybe. That can happen at any moment. And it's like this uncontrollable, it's like a knee-jerk, physical knee-jerk reaction, but of the soul, of the mind, of who knows. But laughter is, it's what it's about. And stand-up comedians, I think it's the reason stand-up is doing so well in 2020, about to be 2021, because it's like philosophy, at least modern day philosophy, combined with, and that, I mean, maybe is just like critique on culture. It's constant critique on culture that we all kind of notice, but love when someone calls out, coupled with these bouts of laughter. It's, when done right, it's pretty magical.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's primal, or it's like atavistic, right? It evokes something from like our ancestral times. Like, oh, we used to sit around the campfire and listen to the funniest, most charismatic person tell stories. And that's what stand-up comedy is at scale.
Yeah. It's amazing. It is truly amazing. Just I would choose, and then we'll shut up about this topic, but I would choose an hour or an hour and a half of one of my favorite comedians over a $100 million produced Netflix show. And maybe that's a symptom, a sign of what we're craving is truth, absurdity, obviously, levity. Laughter, levity, and at least for me, over just, you know, $100 million produced, show on Netflix or movie on Netflix. It's really interesting.
I mean, I think there are serious things, and there's a lot of virtue in bringing a lot of intensity and passion to what we do and to the changes we want to see in the world. I also think that everyone could stand to take themselves a little less seriously, myself included.
Right. Likewise. Yes, definitely. It's I need to tell myself that every day. Okay, so going into mental health and getting into psychedelics, to set the stage for this deep dive into psychedelics, Dylan, can you give listeners a little bit of the background of your relationship with mental health and truly mental illness, to try to separate the synonymization of mental health with mental illness?
I grew up in a working class family in Southern California, a lot of love in our family, but our family was just annihilated by mental illness. Probably worst of all, my mother is severely mentally ill, a lot of struggles with depression, psychosis, schizophrenia. So it was a major part of our life and my life growing up, created a little bit of a turbulent home, despite a lot of unconditional love from my father, who's my hero. And ultimately, we didn't stand a chance trying to help her, which at the time I thought was because we just like didn't have money and didn't know what we were doing. And you know, now I know is because it was just a wicked problem and most people don't stand a chance. And then we need to get to some of these problems at the root before you get to a point of schizophrenia or psychosis for a lot of people. And we ultimately lost her to homelessness. So she's one of the 500,000 homeless people in the U.S. today. So utterly lost to mental illness.
Are you able to touch base with her? Are you able to maintain a relationship at all?
No, she will pop in to my family from time to time, but when somebody is that far gone, I don't really know how you help them. There's like a divorce from any thread of like reality. I think it can manifest in different ways for some people. For her, it's quite violent.
Right. It's like trying to stop polio with conversation.
It is. It's actually fascinating when you meet somebody who's like sort of lived with or like spent a lot of time really closely with psychosis. It's really kind of like a psychedelic experience. It's almost indescribable if you haven't experienced it. Like trying to have a conversation, like you said, polio, like with somebody who cannot have a conversation. There's like no thread to follow. It's jarring and all over the place and like purely irrational. And it's like very tragic, and helped, shape me and my family. And is a big reason that I've been very curious, and about the mind for a long time. And as I've built a couple other software companies, have always been keeping my sort of finger to the forefront of mental health care. And when I had the opportunity to, you know, build a telemedicine company in mental health care, decided to pick something that helped me in my mental health, which has been psychedelic therapy for the last 11 years.
With that as the background, the family history and familiarity from that perspective. And I'm so sorry to hear that about your mother, and just that, my mother is bipolar, and it's something we've chatted about before and bonded on. My sister took her own life with major depression. I have a brother with bipolar, and it is, grew up with it. It was just, I thought the universe, and then realized when I was 17 or 18, oh no, this is maybe just my universe. And this is, like I said, it's just family members with any illness. And most of the time it is uncontrollable. Walk me through that as the background into today, and maybe start with 11 years ago, your entry into psychedelic therapy, or this whole world of potential therapy for mental illness.
Yeah. I think the way that I coped with growing up in a pretty turbulent home is my friends were tremendously helpful, right? I had support systems, and like a really loving parent that I think, you know, was able to prop me up. I just like threw myself in my work. So I was an animal. I probably slept 5 hours a night in school. Was like straight A student, played sports, like science Olympiad, academic decathlon. Like I was just like, I'm going to achieve and succeed. And I was fortunate to get into a good school and scholarship, and thought that I was hitting all these milestones and like had it figured out and had conquered this thing that, you know, was a big part of my life. And about 11 years ago, when I was 20, I had a close friend who really pushed me to try MDMA. At the time, that's commonly like known as like ecstasy, which is currently in phase 3 clinical trials for PTSD. At the time, I would not touch any drug. Like, I grew up with an addict. It was terrifying to me, you know, even if I would drink several nights a week as a college student. This person was really trusted and really pushed me to do it. And for me, when I did it, it sort of catalyzed a fundamental transformation for me into both realizing that I had a ton of work to do, that I had, I grew up with some pretty traumatic experiences, and that the way I coped was by putting up a shell and essentially having a personality of like very, very, very low emotionality and ability to sort of feel and like connect with others in a sympathetic level. And for the first time in, you know, maybe since I was like a young child, like my like heart blew open and I could feel like connected to other people, and saw that I may have had like my friends, but I did not like people, and I did not like the world, and was not a positive person, which I'd been blind to. Over the last 11 years, both MDMA and other psychedelics have just been, you know, utterly transformational and a pillar for me in my, you know, personal, emotional, ontological, social development. Not like the be all end all, like I've done a lot of work across a lot of other vectors. But for me, like, and it's not like this for everybody, I wouldn't be who I am. I wouldn't be building the things I am. I wouldn't have the relationships with people I have, you know, if I wasn't able to access these tools. I don't know how I could possibly like broken through and gotten to, you know, who and where I am today without them.
Walk me through your personal path, and then also just the parallel path of the public discourse and research over those 11 years, starting with just that first experience with MDMA, and literally like, go deep into the long form answer of what was that like for you after you got over the fear and hesitation, and you did it, not to encourage this for others, but just to elucidate what that experience was like.
Yeah, I guess I should like preface everything with, you know, I'm the founder and CEO of Mindbloom, a consumer psychedelic therapy company, but I'm not like a doctor or clinician, and all my views are my own. I think the simplest way to describe what I said is it like blew my heart open. I could not just feel this amount of like joy and warmth, but a level of like connection to others. So MDMA is often called an empathogen, or a pathogenic psychedelic. And that's because it can make you feel this sense of empathy and connection, and warmth that, you know, is very hard to access otherwise. It's a big reason that it's used right now on PTSD clinical trials. It's because it allows people to engage with their traumas, in a way that they're not otherwise able to, because they are in this open, warm, receptive emotional state. It's the most called like emotional of any psychedelic medicine. And for me, about that time in my life and still ongoing, the big thing that I continue to work on and you know, really realized then was it was like the emotional side of my development that was really atrophied. That the cognitive and the cerebral was just fine, and I was continuing to work at that. But the emotional, you know, part of me was weak.
What was the, walk me through the next 24 hours, 48 hours, just that experience. How long did it last? Was there a come down? Were you 72 hours in? You were like, oh my God, this is an answer that people should be talking about more. Walk me through the whole narrative arc in your head.
Oh, wow. I think for better or worse, one of the things I've always prided myself on is being like a pretty radically independent thinker. And maybe that gets me into trouble where my knee-jerk reaction to anything is to try to think of the opposite and be contrarian. And so I think the first thing I realized was like, I've been lied to. I was terrified of this. It's, still, not legal, but soon, will be an FDA approved medication most likely. And it just was clear to me that there was a truth here, that this was, at least for me, was good for me. And I imagine it was good for a lot of other people. And it just seemed broken that here was this stigmatized, illegal, puts holes in your brain's substance that did not feel that way. And the experience itself is like, feels almost very sobering. It's, whereas say alcohol, dulls your senses, psychedelics, including MDMA, can heighten and enhance your senses and have like a very lucid feeling. So the whole thing was very surprising. And for me, there was this both catharsis and also sort of like noetic, like knowledge that I had a lot to work on and like my journey was just beginning.
What does noetic mean?
Like a deep, deep sense of knowing, like deep sense of knowing. So I don't know if you've ever had an experience where it might even be hard to put into words, but it's just like this fundamental innate sense of understanding.
Yeah. I thought I was going to take mushrooms one time and they were like, no, we're doing ayahuasca. And I was like, oh shit. Okay. Let's do it.
Buckle up.
Yeah, exactly. Like let's go to level 7 very fast. And yeah, noetic. That's a great, great word for a lot of the, personal discovery and insights from it. It was just, yeah, there was no need for any other source or fact checking. It was just like, oh yeah, that's true. That's a great term for it. What was the, had you already approached, psychiatry therapy, for where you were at 20, or was this something that was just budding and you were kind of like, I think or maybe it was just went from recreational to, okay, there's work I need to be doing here.
I had done therapy a few times. Growing up in a turbulent household, I had, a few moments where like, I thought I had to go to therapy, or my whole family had to go to therapy. But for me, I had convinced myself and every therapist had seen that like, I was just fine. Like straight A student, friends, sports, well-adjusted, like clearly everything is going great. And so for me, it was almost like this was the, the revelation that everything was not going great, that there was like a lot of work to be done, that it wasn't just in a point of like optimizing and continuing to achieve, but that there was like some deep work that needed to be done. Or I was, you know, not going to have the life or be the person that I didn't even like who I was maybe. Right. That, and I think that's, for me, it's like one of the most common motifs I have during these experiences is I think I'm going in for some fundamental insight into my personality or character or way that I want to be or become, or, you know, some creative breakthrough about my life or my work. And oftentimes I just return to like the importance of my relationships and my, I would call it emotional intelligence, but like my emotional state and my emotional connections with other people and how much I need to work on that and cherish that and how much I'm not appreciating and bringing gratitude to my relationships with others. So, yeah, maybe I'm still continuing to learn the same thing, but it does feel like one of those upward spirals.
Right, right. What is the, and then the, feeling of being lied to. What is, real quick, what is the physiological feeling after MDMA 2 days later, 3 days later? Is there a come down?
It depends. There's like a degree of neurotoxicity with MDMA, sometimes like dehydration. So, you know, generally, people may feel like okay to pretty positive the day after, maybe drained. And then 2 or 3 days later, as their brain begins replenishing the serotonin that's been sort of shuttled across the synapse and expended, for lack of a better word, there could be a come down. And for most people, describe it as like no worse than a hangover, but it, you know, really depends on the person. So I've had experiences where I felt great the next few days, some where it's like a little lagged out after, call it 2 or 3 days. But generally it's no worse than a night of drinking.
Yeah. Okay. The, outside of the personal experience, what has been happening in the world around psychedelics in the last 11 years? And for listeners, I think, we'll sequence this conversation around the last 10 years, 11 years, and the next 10 years, because you're right in one foot in both worlds. You're not only obviously building on what we are collectively starting to understand around psychedelics in the last 10 years, which is just probably seemed light years away from where we would have been 15 years ago, 20 years ago, to certainly growing up as a kid where psychedelics was just like that, that might as well be a fully loaded, assault rifle that people are playing with.
Incredible analogy. Yeah.
That's like what in my mind and as a kid we're probably similar ages. That's just what it was. It was kind of just what it felt like. That was the area code that you're talking about when you're talking about drugs. It's like, you know, someone making C4 in their basement was as bad as the kid that tried acid senior high school. Walk us through those last 11 years. And then also the other foot that you have is really maybe even more intentionally on where this is going. And good Lord, is there so much innovation happening in this realm, in this world, Mindbloom being one of the leading companies within it. But yeah, walk us through the last 11 years outside of your personal experience and what's been happening, around the world.
Yeah. So probably for the first years after my first personal experience, I thought that I had discovered a secret that the idea that psychedelics were good for you, that they like defragged the hard drive, cleared the cobwebs, like were this catalyst for personal growth, and my mental health and well-being was like a secret. And then I discovered, what had been really going on for the last 40 or 50 years now, which is that there has been a ton of research into the therapeutic benefits of psychedelics, across a range of them, LSD, psilocybin, and MDMA more recently. Over the last 10 years or so, there has just been this explosion and like revitalization of not just like academic research, but actual like clinical studies around psychedelics, bringing them as close as possible on the verge of to market, in a way that can actually transform the mental health care system.
What are some of those milestones that the world has seen, with the Johns Hopkins research, or just kind of some of the milestones over the last 10 years, 11 years, as it comes from, as it's gone from a secret to where we are.
Let me put into perspective how big the milestones are. So, so the average drug takes about like 13 years and $2.5 billion of research and development to bring to market. The Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, MAPS, it's a nonprofit and public benefits corporation, has been like fighting tirelessly for an insane amount of time to, in any way that they could, help bring these transformational medicines to people who need them most. And so they've approached a lot of different frameworks around legalization, decriminalization, advocacy. And the one that looks like it's going to be really, really successful right now is actually taking drugs through the FDA approval process to bring them to market. So that's like preclinical stage one, stage two, stage three clinical trials. Today, MDMA-assisted psychotherapy through MAPS is in the second part of phase three clinical trials. So like it is right at the precipice and the cusp, you know, maybe 1 to 3 years out from FDA approval. They're starting with PTSD, but that will be like the lead domino to bring, you know, both MDMA as well as a ton of other compounds, you know, to people for, you know, this mental health care crisis, which is, you know, from a lot of accounts perceived as like the number one sans COVID public healthcare crisis in the US right now.
Yeah, maybe even globally. I remember reading in a study in 2018 that the world is closer to world peace than it is to inner peace, and that more people died each year. It was either 2018. It's in one an essay that I wrote called Information Pathology like a year and a half ago. The exact study and the date, but it's the moment in time, I think it was 2015, in which it happened, where more people were dying from self-inflicted violence and self-inflicted injury, like overdoses, even accidental overdoses, than there were people dying in all of the conflict and violence around the world combined. And that's, I mean, that's just,
Without a doubt, suicide is the second or third leading cause of death for people under 30 years old. Depression is the number one cause of disability worldwide. And in the US, people with depression, this is just one of many, you know, clinical ailments, cost the healthcare system 50% more than people without depression. So like the amount of comorbidities for someone who's depressed and other conditions that they have is crazy. Yeah, like 50% of Americans will have a pretty serious mental illness, like clinically diagnosed in their lifetime, which doesn't speak to the rest of the people who will still have, you know, mental anguish that can be, you know, solved for or treated. And when you really dig into like the research about today's existing treatment options, it's a pretty bleak picture.
Yeah. And if that's 50%, then that's basically every one of us will be directly or indirectly affected. Someone close to us that we love.
I think there have been a lot of surprising things, you know, building a mental health care company over the last couple of years. One has been that I have not met a single person who does not have a first degree connection to a really serious mental illness or mental health care challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's just so disconnected from the public discourse. It's getting better. Each year when my sister passed away and took her own life 20 years ago, it was about, 20 years ago, 19 years ago. My parents told me that she had mono, never talked about depression. And I didn't hear the word depression or the word anxiety until I was maybe, I didn't hear the word anxiety. I didn't know what anxiety was like a thing, maybe until I was 19 or 20, 5 years after my sister took her life. And depression was certainly, like I said, my family told me it was mono, and told my other siblings it was mono. We've come such a long way in the last 19 years, but it's still just what you just said highlights how big of a disconnection we have from how we're impacted by it and how much we talk about it, the public discourse. Mm-hmm. I probably hear about the specter of climate crisis going to have some metaphorical or literal tidal wave on me, my family, future generations, 7 times a day, mm-hmm. versus, and hear about that, versus the discourse around this friend, that friend, this friend, that friend that I think about in my head that's dealing with mental illness, and no one is really talking about it. I think it's where a lot of the excitement for those that are impacted by it and somewhat up to date or literate around this recent research is so excited, because the research around psychedelics has been, it's, well, like you said, it's a pretty bleak, you take that out of the equation, it's, you could have been a psychiatrist 26 years ago prescribing the exact same medicine in 1994, gone out of medicine, come back in 2020. And it's like, oh, I'm still prescribing the exact same medicine. There's been so little to no innovation in this space outside of this innovation within psychedelics. Do you mind walking listeners through some more of these milestones in the last 10 years or the research around it, around the efficacy? Because it, from my perspective, it doesn't seem like it's incremental. Of like, oh, let's get excited because it's incremental. It's far more exciting than just, oh, it's 10% better.
Yeah. So when you look at the research around ketamine therapy, which is the only legally prescribable psychedelic therapy right now, which we could talk about a bit, and that's what the clinicians that we partner with at MindBloom are providing. When you look at MDMA-assisted therapy, psilocybin-assisted therapy, LSD, you look at even other medicines like Ibogaine, and there are a lot of other medicines coming down the pipeline as well. What you see is just a picture of such an exponentially more effective treatment than existing treatment options that it's quite honestly like stunning. I think a really concrete example of that is when I started MindBloom, I went out and spoke to like hundreds of psychiatrists and therapists, and my expectation was that they were going to think what we were doing was really, really weird. Like, we are recruiting clinicians to use psychedelic therapy, through our online platform, building, this content and therapeutic suite around it. And we thought people were going to be like, that's nuts, and what I have pretty much universally heard is we are currently treating patients with hammers and chisels. What we have does not work. We're tired of using these medicines. Either I am super on board with psychedelics, I am really, really enthusiastic because I've seen the research, or I am so skeptical. But I don't, even if I'm that skeptical, we have to use other treatment options. So like, like I'm going to use them when they're coming down the pipeline, because what we have isn't working. It's been pretty, pretty stunning. So the down the fairway or vanilla established like psychiatric community who you might think would see psychedelics as very fringy are actually a lot more on board than people know, because the research is just so black and white compelling.
And walk us through some of the research in the last 10 years. Are there any stats that you could point to, high-level stats on efficacy in comparison to other treatments?
Yeah. So I can give you like an example from, say, ketamine therapy.
Yeah, please.
So ketamine right now is predominantly used for depression or treatment-resistant depression. So like we talked about 50% of Americans will have a mental illness in their lifetime. There are nearly 40 million Americans who are on SSRI antidepressants right now. Those are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Zoloft and Lexapro. So these are essentially blocking serotonin.
40 million. That's like, if there are 150 million adults, and not all of those will be adults, but that's like one out of every five adults. If maybe 10 million are children, that's insane.
That right. And a lot of people who receive a diagnosis or have symptoms will not get on those medicines. So the amount of right. people who have the constellation of symptoms that we call depression is even higher.
Right.
So when you dig into the data, what you find is with SSRIs, they take 6 to 8 weeks to work on average. So you don't even know if they're working for a long time. They come with terrible side effects. So weight gain, sexual dysfunction, insomnia, mood swings, sometimes suicidality. And then on top of that, 30 to 40% of people are completely treatment resistant. So they'll wait 6 to 8 weeks, have side effects, get another one, get another one, get another one. And they might be on 5 to 10 the next year. Nothing works for them. When you also dig into the research, what some people find is that there are questions over whether or not they're effective at all in the long term. So they have about an effectiveness, a long-term effectiveness rate for about a third of people who take them, 30 to 40%. And when you track people who say didn't get into an SSRI study, who are like a control group, they often like have the long-term remission of symptoms at about the same rate as people who take antidepressants. So there are big conversations about whether they're effective long-term or if they can just sort of get people out of like a short-term funk so you can actually like work with them to create like behavioral and emotional changes.
Do you mind breaking that down in layman's terms of like an example? Like a real life example of what some of those big words like remission might mean.
Oh, they just don't have depression symptoms. So thanks. So there are different like scales that people and clinicians might use to look at how severe or whether or not somebody has depression. So like, we use those in MindBloom. So if you take these scales, you know, questions around how are you feeling? If it's like anxiety, it might be like, are you feeling restless? Do you have trouble sleeping? Do you worry a lot? And like, how frequently do you do these things? You can assign somebody like a score for that's the magnitude of their symptoms. And so you look at how that trends over time. And so those are like clinical outcomes of treatments that you might give people is how their scales and scores, progress. With existing treatment options like antidepressants, what you see is that for 30 to 40% of people, there's essentially no improvement in their symptoms. About a third of people long-term will have reduction in symptoms, but it looks like about a third of people long-term will have reduction in symptoms if you don't give them any medication. So there's questions around whether or not the medication is working at all, or people are now just a little bit hooked on an SSRI that's really challenging to get off of because of the withdrawals and the side effects.
Yeah. Walk me through the comparison of what we're seeing with things like ketamine.
So if we find that antidepressants are effective for say 30 to 37% of people, ketamine therapy, when given with no therapy whatsoever, just like straight ketamine into your bloodstream as like a medication only, no therapeutic intervention, seems to be effective for anywhere from 65 to 75% of people.
Wow. So twice as effective.
Twice as effective. And that's with no therapeutic intervention whatsoever. And therapy intervention is tough. When you look at the data, most people take the medication without the therapy. So about people who have like behavioral healthcare issues, about 57% just take medication like SSRIs, 33% will do medication plus therapy, and only 10% of people will just go to, you know, talk therapy and work with a therapist.
What does MindBloom focus on for listeners and why that focus today in 2020?
Yeah. So our mission at MindBloom is to transform lives, to transform the world. We really believe through our experiences and the research that psychedelics have the potential to make a dent in global human suffering and elevate humanity's collective wisdom, compassion, and consciousness. And so we think a lot about how do we get these medicines out there and help people. And so our big vectors are dramatically increasing access to treatment, creating outsized clinical outcomes like we just discussed, and just delivering like transformational, exceptional client experiences.
And is it just ketamine today? Are there ideas to expand beyond that?
Yeah, today it's just guided ketamine therapy. You can kind of think of it as like the telemedicine platform with psychiatric clinicians of like a HIMSS with an online therapeutic or content platform similar to like Calm with like a coaching platform similar to like Noom or FutureFit. So we have psychiatric clinicians who are prescribing that we're partnered with for depression and anxiety. They are sending people, you know, a balloon box that's sort of like a welcome kit with everything people need to do psychedelic therapy at home. So eye mask, journal, medicine, some medical devices that they need to make sure that they're safe. We pair them with a specialized guide.
So crazy. This is so crazy because, well, even, and I'm also appreciating all of the funny adjectives we're using for this topic. It's just, even when we first spoke, which was maybe a year and a half ago or so, the idea of just mailing someone psychedelics and then getting it, you know, in a beautiful box, being able to discuss it with a doctor, you know, via telemedicine, and just have that that a year and a half ago is unthinkable. In my head, I was like, oh, that's like 5 years down the road. It's like maybe 7 years down the road. COVID has been, I imagine, a huge tailwind for this, and a expansion into telemedicine. But it's just, shit, even taking out the year and a half perspective, a couple years ago, 5 years ago, this just would have been unthinkable for a company to be able to just mail you psychedelics in your home. I just want to take a second to plant the flag in 2020 of how crazy that would have been 5 years ago to think about, to say. Oh, that was a good conversation happening right there. But I want to tell you about something also worth talking about, and that is Below the Line sponsor of Tiny Capital. Tiny Capital is, well, let's start with how painful selling a business is. It is extremely, extremely stressful, painful, uncertain. It is all of the things you build your own business to not have to go through. Just being in someone else's, you're really the ball's in their court most of the time when you're selling a business. And it is a drag, that is to put it extremely mildly. But selling your business doesn't have to be a miserable task. You don't have to go through the months of negotiation, legal fees, only to get to watch the new owners trash the business you built. With Tiny Capital, you can go to tinycapital.com and you can have a response in a day or two. They will make an offer in 7 days if they're interested, and then the close of the deal will be within 30 days. It's not 5 months, 7 months of uncertainty of paperwork back and forth. They will respond in a day or two, make an offer within a week, and then close within a month. It is the dream scenario for selling your business. I've had a few friends sell their businesses to Tiny Capital, and it is as good as it sounds. They have truly built, as founders themselves, they've built the dream scenario for selling your business. So check them out, tinycapital.com, if you are interested in selling your online business. Below the Line is also brought to you by TechMeme. When the New Yorker asked Mark Zuckerberg how he gets his news, he said one news source he definitely follows is TechMeme. For 3 years and nearly 800 episodes, their short episode called Ride Home, the TechMeme Ride Home podcast, has been Silicon Valley's best tech news podcast. If you want the latest tech news and analysis of what's happening today, yesterday, this week within tech news, it's a great 15 to 20 minute long episode each day that gives you that digest. It's more than just headlines. You could get a robot that would read you headlines. It is the context around the latest news. It's not just the top stories or top posts, top tweets. It's all of the conversations that are happening around those stories, those posts. It is a great analysis. In my viewpoint, it is basically the daily digest you want if you want to stay up to date with tech news. The TechMeme Ride Home is like the TLDR as a service for tech news. And you can listen to it in your car, on your jog, and within 15 to 20 minutes, you got all you need to stay up to date. Search your podcast app now for Ride Home and subscribe to the TechMeme Ride Home podcast.
Ketamine was FDA approved 50 years ago and has been used as an anesthetic and analgesic across the world since then. One of the reasons that it's used in every hospital an ER in the country every single day, is that it has this incredible safety profile and track record. It's like one of the only anesthetics that doesn't decrease your heart and breathing rate. About 20 years ago, they started to discover when people came into the emergency room with depression and got ketamine, they left without depression. And so since that time, there's been this tremendous body of study. And now this massively growing number of clinics and psychiatrists and providers who are using ketamine therapy for clinical depression, anxiety, PTSD, OCD, substance use disorder, chronic pain. The reason that we've taken a remote oriented approach is we just think a lot about like, how do we increase access to these treatments so more and more people who really need them can get them, especially given this massive mental health care crisis.
And how much more effective it is than the status quo, right?
Yeah. Like ketamine therapy right now is generally anywhere between like $600 and $1,200 a session, with a psychiatrist or ketamine clinic. Also, it's only available to people who can get to some sort of urban center like LA, San Francisco, New York. And so if you're a single mother of four living outside 4 hours outside of Wichita, Kansas, one, you probably can't afford a $1,000 session ketamine therapy. And two, who's going to drive you 4 hours, sit with you for 2 hours, drive you 4 hours back, 4, 8, 20 times over the next year so that you can get treatment. So that's a big reason that we're doing remote. This allows us to dramatically increase access by getting it to people who just literally don't have access to it physically, dropping the price for people.
Walk me through exactly the logistics of someone that comes in to something like MindBloom with symptoms of depression and then, I don't know, a year later has no symptoms of depression. What does it look like? Is it... I just walk people through the exact, like you go on the website, it's three sessions, just everything, the specific logistics.
Give me the how it works page.
Yeah. Basically, because I think it's, I can imagine listeners just listening, wanting to know, okay, how the hell does this work? In this new brave new world of psychedelic therapy.
So come to mindbloom.co, soon to be.com. And we have like a candidate survey where people can fill it out to learn if they're a fit for treatment based on having symptoms of anxiety or depression, as well as, potential exclusionary criteria that make you not a fit for treatment, such as pregnant. For people who are a fit, they can schedule like a free exploration call with one of our guides to learn more about treatment. Cause we know it's like a huge step for a lot of people. From there, you can put down a deposit for a 4-session program. And so we have a number of different programs right now. Everybody starts with the basics of psychedelic therapy with Dr. Palios, who's our science director at MindBloom. And is one of the principal investigators on the MDMA clinical trials with MAPS, and actually ran one of the very first ketamine for depression studies at NYU about 10 years ago, or several years ago. And then was also a study therapist on like the landmark psilocybin for cancer anxiety study that's referenced in like Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind book and a lot of other places. Once they select their program, they're connected with a psychiatric clinician. It could be a psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner who does like a full-on 45 minutes an hour deep dive video consult to diagnose somebody with anxiety or depression, based on their symptoms and their state of being in life. From there, if they're qualified for treatment, then they are shipped a Bloom box in the mail that has medication.
And by the way, this isn't for listeners. This isn't just a commercial for MindBloom. It's just you all are, I think, just at the forefront of this whole new world. So that's why, I'm an investor and I was like, how does this all work? Because it also accelerated.
This would be a boring commercial. We could make it much nicer.
I think 90 more seconds on just how it works, I think is, I think it's time well spent. So keep going.
Yeah. We match people to a guide. So this is like a transformational life addiction coach who is trained in both coaching, but also has, training and knowledge on psychedelic states. And this person helps our clients prepare both the mindset and their physical setting at home. We do virtual sessions with people. We have virtual group sessions that people can pop into to integrate their experiences afterwards. We provide music and meditations for each experience and personalize them to people over time, all really designed to help people get the most out of their experiences so that they can have this heightened emotional state, which for a lot of people, they haven't had in like 10, 20, 30 years of feeling of not being depressed or anxious. In addition, they've had like psychological insights from their hour-long ketamine therapy sessions with eye mask music and meditations. Coaches and guides help them work through some of that and give them the tools to unpack it and decide what actions to take next. And then through like a messaging platform, we help sort of keep people accountable to making the behavioral and changes that you know that they're trying to make and support them throughout the entire journey.
What is the cost if it's not $1,000 like it has been conventionally?
So Mind Bloom, for the first program, it's $250 a session. And then for people who continue on, it's $150 a session. So we drop the cost like 70 to 80% from the average ketamine therapy provider.
And, you mentioned the, and how many sessions should someone expect if they're,
Right now, the clinicians generally start with a 4-session program. So they start with a small dose and titrate people up over the next few doses to help get them to the, sort of optimal therapeutic level. Right now, our outcomes data is demonstrating effectiveness for 80 to 90% of people who are, completing treatment.
Wow. So 80 to 90% of people are, it's effective for them.
It's closer to 90, but we say 80 to 90.
And what is effective? Slight increase? Is it?
It's like a meaningful decrease in symptoms. But I think, and we're going to be partnering with some like major academic and research institutions to run clinical studies based on like real world evidence of these outcomes. But one of the things that we really want to track that we haven't yet gotten enough data on through like our first 1,000 patients or so is how do people's long-term symptoms look? And I think that a lot of people come in because they want out of this really challenging emotional state that they're in. They're in like really severe pain that they've been in for a long time. And now for the first time, they are not in that state. They have insight into like what they want to work on and improve in their life. And they're also in this neuroplastic state where their brains are like literally primed for 3 to 14 days with a state called synaptogenesis, where they can actually create like healthier neural connections and pathways in their brain. And so we see the big opportunity to actually help people integrate and drive those emotional and behavioral changes that stick long-term, which is not something I don't think we've yet built or hit on today, and is the big opportunity to help drive not just immediate change for people, but lasting change for people, which is really what this is all about.
You mentioned integration. Do you mind talking a little bit more about and you also mentioned the success rate without ongoing therapy. Do you mind touching on the that assistance that can come outside of just the dosing of a psychedelic agent?
Yeah, I think you can break out psychedelic therapy or psychedelic experiences into 3 phases. So there's preparation, there's the experience itself, and then there's integrating the experience. So going in, preparing like a positive, calm, expansive mindset, and being in a physical setting that is safe and warm and comfortable and isn't going to distract you and be intrusive can have like a massive impact on the experience itself and what people get out of it. 2, like what you do during the experience matters. So for a lot of our clients, like maybe most clients have never gone through like a psychedelic experience before. And so they're sort of coached and trained and supported into how to do it. So at Mind Bloom, the protocol, which is very similar to a lot of other psychedelic therapy protocols, that have been built over 50 years of research plus, is to lay down with an eye shade, lyricless, not too distracting music. We help prime people's mindsets with some meditation and we call it brain candy snippets. And then immediately after the experience, beginning what's called integration, which is taking the emotional and cognitive insights and changes and actually figuring out what to do with them and unpack them. Our science director is an incredible analogy. He talks about how you are collecting these like baubles and trinkets from your mind. And if you just like take them and put them on the shelf and leave them without like figuring out what they are, observing them, then they'll just like gather dust and like rot. So they have to be continually like cleaned and collected and, you know, taken care of. So integration, whether that's someone's own integration practice or working with, you know, a professional therapist or guide, is taking these insights and actually deciding like what to do next about them and making sure that you're actually making those changes in your life, you know, in like a safe, supported way. So Mind Bloom, people journal immediately after the experience. And then the days after, they'll meet with their guide, sometimes their clinician, to unpack the experience, get the tools to integrate, and get, you know, support throughout the integration process. I was just saying, I think one opportunity area that say Mind Bloom hasn't yet built is helping people integrate long term and not just throughout like the 1 to 3 months of, you know, of each program. Because I mean, I think one of our coaches has a saying that like life is integration. Like we're in a constant state of taking the things that we're learning and the changes we want to make and trying to like actually integrate those into our life. I think that's a major pitfall. People have this emergent experience and they think that it'll just last, but it doesn't. It only lasts if you actually like leverage it to create those changes in your behaviors that are really driven by changes in like your brain chemistry and neural pathways, in a way that actually sticks for the long term.
Right. That's interesting. I'd never heard of synaptogenesis of that time period of 3 to 10 days or whatever you said of creating those new pathways.
That's why often in a psychedelic experience, you have what's called transient hypofrontality, or like your prefrontal cortex kind of shuts down or like diminishes. But at the same time, you have the state of synaptogenesis induced by what's called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. It's like HGH for the brain. So people can simultaneously, which maybe you've experienced, feel dumb but highly creative. And that's because as your brain is having these pathways come up, it doesn't have the old pathways that it used to be able to rely on. And so it has to like create new ones, and it's able to create new ones. And so for a lot of people, that feels like creativity or feels like insight or feels like this noetic feeling that we discussed earlier, this deep sense of knowing. But there's actually something going on in the brain where you can take that and more easily and readily create healthier, you know, behaviors and ways of being in the world.
Yeah, a quick synopsis of my experience. I took it very seriously. A calling of sorts for 2 or 3 years but I just didn't feel like I could do it when I was running my company. And then we sold it to Airbnb, and I was at Airbnb for a while and just felt like, okay, it's a little more stable now. I feel like I can dabble in this adventure, and had different doctors and psychologists just be resources to help and make sure that I was approaching it the right way. I had a heart condition. So I wanted to make sure I was just being really safe. And found the right guide. And like I said, I thought I was going to take 5 grams of mushrooms, and I got there, and I was like, I've never told the story on the podcast, but I got there and I was like, all right. So I chatted with my doctor, shout out to, well, no, I won't give a shout out to my doctor because it's still a little, that's a little too below the line. No shout out given to any doctor that ever helped me with this. But I said, you know, my doctor said that I can have, I could go up to 5 grams. And they were like, okay, come on in and let's put your bags down. And I was like, I also wanted to know, about 10 minutes later, I put my bags down. I was like, I also wanted to know, is it typical to do mushrooms overnight? And it's kind of intense diet for the last 2 weeks for mushrooms. And they were like, we're doing ayahuasca this evening. And I was like, oh, shit. And they were like, is that okay? Did you know that? What did you think was? And I was like, from that moment, and I'd already been training my mind because I'd been given the guidance to train your mind to let go in the moments leading up to it. Just things happen, let go. Things happen to prepare. What's that?
I was saying, like, trust, let go, be open.
That's, yeah, exactly. That's the mantra. Right. And so I was already, I'd already invested in that for 2 weeks of just things come up, let go.
And, you're ready to rock.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and the reason that they tell you to trust and let go, and because during the psychedelic trip, things will come up, and not necessarily, at least with ayahuasca or mushrooms, not necessarily be what you would design, but or desire, but as that's the adage is, it's the experience you need, not the experience you want. And so it can be negative at times, and so it only gets more negative if you cling to the preconceived notions of what you wanted out of the experience. You need to let go. So that was, I'd already been kind of primed to just let go. So I was like, yep, okay, without, you know, moments of hesitation, I was like, all right, well, that's what we're doing, then let's do it. And took a hefty dose. And then I pretty large 6'5" guy. So I was like, all right, they asked a few hours in if I wanted to up the dose, and I was like, let's do it. And there was this, I won't go into too much detail of just the whole experience, but it certainly was on the other side. It was profound. There's no other word for it. It was profound. And this was about 2 years ago. And then afterwards, there was this integration experience that I worked with a psychologist with, and an ongoing 6 months of integration of the experience. And I had so many insights that during it that I won't, you know, bore listeners with because they're individual. But it certainly was, one of them was that I had this experience. There were four parts to it. And the first larger part was just joy and bliss, and everything is just awesome. And then the next experience was a little bit shorter. It was almost like four seasons, but it was obviously all just happening in my mind, and it was all white and geometric colors. I didn't have any really hallucinations of like a panther or things that certain people have. It was just
common misconception.
Yeah. So it was just like, I'm seeing a lot of color. My eyes are closed. I'm seeing a lot of colors, but there's no desire to see anything other than what I'm just seeing. Just all of these shapes going back and forth, and all, it's every color, and every shape, and an infinite pattern of them. And went from, this is just sheer bliss, to curiosity, what else is out there? Bliss is kind of boring, and it's just, you know, time kind of disappeared. So that big chunk, I had some notion of it being a big chunk, but also it was just like, this can't be all there is. It can't just be bliss all the time. And so the next chunk was curiosity, what else is there? Then the next chunk was going towards uncertainty. And instead of curiosity, it was like, let me leave this certain bliss. And this curiosity has taken me now towards uncertainty. And then, and that uncertainty introduced this feeling in this third phase of like, oh no, what did you do? You left the bliss. Why did you do that? Why did you let your curiosity take you away from that? And then it was, oh shit, this is about to get really bad, and I'm never going to get back to that bliss. And then it was that investment of just let go, just go into it. It's going to get really bad, but don't stop, just go into it. And that last part, the fourth kind of season was, this is pure fear. This is pure, just pure fear. It was nothing substance of like, this is what to fear. It was just, this is pure fear. This is why you shouldn't have let go, moved on from the bliss. And then I just said, and then it was just like, go into it. And it was just like pixel thin fear. This fourth phase that I was fearful of was the thinnest of them all. And it lasted a microsecond, and boom, I was back to bliss, right on the other side of just the fear. And I went through those four phases. In my head, it was like 400 times. Just did it so many times. of going into the fear and then bouncing into, and it being nothing, having no substance to it, and bouncing right into pure bliss. And then, oh, this is kind of boring, curiosity then.
That's what I was just saying. Almost sounds like cycling through like the stages of insight in Vipassana meditation.
Maybe. I'm not familiar with Vipassana meditation, but I it was like there are parts, there are four parts to life. And if you want life to be a party, then obviously the root of a party is multiple parts. And then I was like, holy shit. It's only a party if it has multiple parts. And that's what a party is, multiple parts. And so it was but the ability to do it 400 times in my head over and over and over again was just so it was so fascinating to run that programming or that that program 400 times and create that neural pathway of go into fear and it's bliss right on the other side. And it's just nothing that you think it's going to be 400 times. That would it in real life, that maybe you can do that like 3 times a year.
How have you integrated that symbol or insight?
I don't know if I've integrated the symbol, but I certainly within, so they told me for 90 days, don't make any life-changing decisions. Day 91, quit Airbnb. Yeah, exactly.
And day all right. You took the advice.
I took the advice. Day 91, quit Airbnb, and loved my time there. But I was like, this is what I need to do for me. And then started podcast, to scale up this little morning concoction, Magic Mind, that I think I've sent you some before. And I was like, this is a gift that I'm like kind of like holding for myself, this morning concoction for, you know, finding a groove and productivity. Let me try to figure out ways to give it to anyone and everyone can. And then felt like, okay, my calling is around angel investing and encouraging, creators, and creating myself and going into the fear. And I had told myself 2 years prior, I'm never going to start any company ever again. That was too fucking painful. And then I was, starting a bunch of things. Symbolically, I'm not sure, but certainly in my life, it was like, okay, I just know there's nothing on the other side of this fear that I have. It's pure bliss, if anything, is on the other side.
That is so cool. That's so powerful.
It really was. And you mentioned Michael Pollan's book. How big of, and Michael Pollan talks about it famously in the book around how it's like a psychedelics, when used appropriately, can be like a fresh coat of snow. And you can recreate, instead of just the grooves that you have with your skis, you can recreate different grooves than the ones that, you know, you just have maybe programmed over 30 years, 40 years. What are the differences between, well, first off, how big of an impact do you think Michael Pollan's book of How to Change Your Mind was as a mainstream kind of milestone for this whole realm?
Yeah, I think it was tremendous. I guess psychedelics been just a huge part of my life for 11 years. And I don't think I can even consider starting Mind Bloom if it's not for like Tim Ferriss, Joe Rogan, Michael Pollan, obviously all the research that everyone's been doing to actually like bring these to people. But in terms of like the cultural or academic or like influential, like people who have like put their like reputations and on the line, like I just see that as so utterly courageous. And I mean, yeah, there's no way I'm doing this if it's not for, you know, Michael Pollan and these other people. It became clear to me that not only was it the truth that these medicines can really, really help a lot of people, but that they're also coming down the pipeline and it looks like are going to be something that society can actually access. But the time was also right because people were openly talking about it. I was not brave enough to talk about it until they were brave enough to talk about it. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. Likewise. Second that. And it's, courage is a great word for it because it's, that is,
it's heroic.
Yeah, heroic. It truly is heroic. And it just breaks down the walls for others to talk about it as well. the, I mean, Silicon Valley is filled with people that have had experiences, but cannot talk about it. And it's, that aside, it's one of the secret powers of Silicon Valley is, as a geographic or network-based locale, if there is one digitally, if not geographically, is that there's this wisdom around these things that is passed, but then not talked about publicly, and it's I think it's to 50% of Americans' detriment that we don't. Not that this is going to be the pinnacle and end all be all of psychiatric therapy and mental illness research, but it certainly is this massive tool that we're just leaving in a shed, hidden,
totally.
And underused.
Well, and the way I think about access is like three vectors. There's making it available to people, like can't even get access to it. There's making it affordable for people. And then the third, which I don't think a lot of people talk about, is just making it approachable to people.
Like, yeah, tell me more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Tim Ferriss and Michael Pollan and a lot of others are doing is by bringing it into the mainstream discourse. But when people hear about psychedelics on 60 Minutes, NPR, Oprah, Dr. Oz, like in surround sound, they start to ease up on the fear and it starts to enter their consideration set. And so, what we're doing at Mindbloom is creating like a friendly, approachable consumer brand. But I just think that a lot of people who've done psychedelics or accessed them suffer from this curse of knowledge cognitive bias where they forget what it's like to have never done something like this, especially for the part of the population who is sort of rigid and risk averse. It's a huge, huge step. So I think you've had Paul Austin on the podcast.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. So like what he's doing for the psychedelic cause by creating a lot of educational content and materials to get, high quality knowledge and resources out there for people, is a critical part of access as well.
Yeah. And I remember reading a study that from first symptoms to treatment with a mental health disorder, it's about 10 years of people just wandering alone, piecemealing, trying to figure it out. And I'll try to put the link in the show notes for that. And I think for something like insomnia, I think it's like 15 years. And it's so people, I think that approachable, right. That's that an approachable piece. I've never heard anyone talk about that, but that's 10 years of someone's life that, that you can, that they'll never get back if it's
so unapproachable. I was really excited when I read, I think your mental wealth blog, because I've been talking about this for 10 years that I don't like the term mental illness or even mental health care, because it creates this like dichotomy between like mentally healthy and mentally ill. And I think for a lot of people, that is a reason why there's like a major stigma in mental health care. And I think the more this becomes part of the public discourse, both mental health care, but also psychedelics, but just like mental well-being in general as like a focal point, the more people will start working on it before it hits that tipping point. Because it's like a, what's it called? Like boiling the frog, where if you like put a frog in water and you slowly boil it, it doesn't realize it doesn't jump out. Well, if you're like symptoms of insomnia or depression or anxiety or malaise, like are slowly building over time, it just becomes the new normal as the baseline increases. And there's not, it's almost better like hit rock bottom really fast so you can go, do something about it than slowly.
Yeah. And I feel like it's also that the discourse that time to treatment, if it's 10 years, would be massively benefited by a solution that works that people are excited to talk about, to where it's not me telling you, Dylan, as a friend talking to you about the symptoms I'm having with insomnia or anxiety or depression, but it's me telling you, I just had the most incredible treatment experience with something that I've been dealing with for 7 years that I probably haven't told you about, but holy hell, this treatment experience really worked, versus something like Prozac. That is, I heard someone recently talk about much of psychiatric tools as you have stimulants, you have depressants, and you have oblivions, and a lot of antidepressant medications are oblivions. They make you oblivious mm-hmm. to things, and that's not necessarily something you want to go sing from the mountaintops of how great and oblivious. It's something has removed your depression, but replaced it with something else. It's not necessarily a stellar experience in its own right.
Yeah. One of our clinical advisors at Mindbloom, his name is Dr. Cameron Sepa. He was a medical director of Mata Health, major like digital therapeutics company for chronic care. And he's now CEO of Maximus, which is like a really innovative men's health company.
Portfolio company. I'm an investor in Maximus.
Beautiful. Okay. Good. So, you know, Dr. Cam. So
I either kind of know what I'm doing or I'm getting way off track, because, that's, but keep going.
Yeah. So, Cam, I know, has this viewpoint. He's a clinical psychologist and psychiatry, lecturer as well. He has this viewpoint that we need to shift the dialogue around therapy from you're sick, something's wrong with you, you have mental illness, let's like fix you, because people will always inherently not want to be a part of that group, to more of like a performance orientation where, Olympic athletes have coaches. I have a CEO coach. I'm sure you've worked with coaches based on the time I've spent with you. And so how do we shift the conversation to like everybody needs like, you know, a coach, and how do we increase access to, you know, professionally trained, licensed therapists, counselors, coaches who can help you live your best life, not help you not be a depressed person, not, you know, have anxiety, not have these like, you know, constellation of symptoms that are,
Tiger Woods at his peak had a coach. Has always had coaches, but it's the best in the world get to that point because they take all of that so seriously. I like that reframing towards performance. The last buckets I want to cover with you is the future, where this is going, and real quick, how does a ketamine therapy, how does that compare to something like Prozac, something that is kind of a pill every day, ongoing? How would that compare for someone that in 2014 tries X and 2021 Y drug Y, but then in 2021 tries ketamine therapy?
Yeah, the goal is lasting change for people. Nobody wants to be on an SSRI every single day, right? I haven't met anybody who's been on one who wouldn't prefer to get off of it, to maybe, you know, desperately wants to get off of it and has tried several times and feels stuck, whether because of the withdrawal symptoms or just needs to be on it to cope. I think one of the big, unique value propositions for psychedelic medicines are that it's a periodic, not frequent treatment, something people can access when they need it. And if it's effective for them, which as we discussed is effective for a large percentage of the population, can have long lasting effects. So in terms of how people access it, I mean, some are like one and done and they're, good for, hopefully their full life, probably not, but for a long time. Other people have things that come up that they want to continue exploring. And I think, the future is going to be a lot of different medicines with a lot of different types of providers and a lot of different sort of like programs to help people get the most out of it. And like one of the big opportunities is to get better at trying to match like the right people to like the right treatment, to the right clinicians or providers or programs, for like the right time in their life. But that's kind of how I think about how the future's going.
And so pragmatically, that's like four treatments and then they're better on an ongoing basis, or six treatments instead of one pill every day.
If people have these treatments and they get out of this state that they're in and then they make behavioral changes in their life, it's entirely possible that they could have long lasting benefits where they don't need to like come back and access these medicines. I mean, I am a client of Mindbloom and I use ketamine therapy once a month, and find that, you know, on an ongoing basis, it's beneficial for me. Psychedelic therapy has been a big part of my life for 11 years, not super frequently, but consistently throughout that time period.
What are some of the side effects of taking it once a month? Not necessarily for you, but that others might experience.
I mean, most likely, absolutely nothing. I mean, one of the reasons that people will use ketamine therapy is because there aren't the side effects of other medications. You know, potential side effects to look out for could be potential issues with like bladder or a kidney, potential. I mean, we monitor and our clinicians monitor people for dependency development. Development, which has not been demonstrated in clinical settings, only in like high dose recreational users. But it's right now, there's not like really clear conclusive evidence that ketamine has a lot of side effects. Some people can report some like bladder issues, and there are like questions around whether that's the nocebo effect because you tell them about it. But most of the potential side effects you see in like high dose people who are abusing it, you know, not in a clinical setting.
What does the next 10 years look like for the innovation around this? So we have today, and are you all in how many states is MindBloom in?
MindBloom's in 6 states right now: California, New York, Florida, New Jersey, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. Soon to be Texas, and we'll be probably 30 states plus by the end of 2021.
Okay, and so today we have the. Wake up, and it's a world where you can remotely and telemedically use psychedelic therapy with ketamine. Which is such a quantum leap from 2 years ago, but where does this world and the innovation go over the next 10 years? And the leading research that might be the canary in the mine of what other alternatives you would imagine you wake up in 2030 and the world looks like with regards to psychedelics.
Yeah. So I think over the next couple of years, we're going to see a massive surge in ketamine therapy, increasingly used as like a frontline treatment as like the predominant treatment option for people with depression, anxiety, and other mood disorders. I think in the next like 5 years.
Over psilocybin or over MDMA?
Well, so MDMA and psilocybin are not yet FDA approved and prescribable and available. So no matter what, I think ketamine therapy, just based on the clinical research based on the providers that we work with and their years of practicing it and seeing transformational results, and you know, the 1,000+ clients that MindBloom has transplatformed as today, we think that in the next several years, we're going to see ketamine therapy or other psychedelics and existing treatment options like SSRIs flip, where instead of 40 million Americans on antidepressants and 20 million Americans on anti-anxiety meds, we'll see a majority of those using psychedelic therapies. In terms of the other therapies, I mean, we're looking at MDMA-assisted therapy, you know, more likely than not being FDA approved in the next like 2 or 3 years. Psilocybin-assisted therapy is in phase 2 clinical trials. There's a company called Compass Pathways that is doing the leading clinical trial for psilocybin-assisted therapy. They're actually a publicly traded company as of about a month ago, and so you can go on and buy a share in the future of psilocybin-assisted therapy. There are also a number of other psychedelics that are in development, including some public companies in Canada that are also running clinical trials for medicines here in the U.S., like a company called MyMed, a company called Field Trip, and there's a company called Atai Life Sciences that is like a holding company for a lot of these compounds. And so we've got LSD, we've got MDMA, we've got ketamine derivatives, ibogaine. There are even some, it's called like phenethylamines. So if anyone's ever heard of like 2CB, that are in clinical trials. So a whole slate of, existing and new compounds that people are developing.
And when you say new developing, is that kind of like a synthetic derivation of a natural compound? What would the reasoning be behind, a synthetic derivation?
It would be interesting to see if somebody can pull it off. There are people who are trying to strip out the psychedelic effects and see if you can just get the synaptogenic or the anti-inflammatory effects of psychedelics So there are also people who are trying to tweak them so that they can patent them and bring them to market. But I mean, when you think about it, like the things that have been synthesized and used, like hasn't been that long since we've been trying to do that. So I think there's like a pretty strong hypothesis that there has to be a medicine that has, or a compound that has not yet been synthesized that will be more effective than previously synthesized ones. And ostensibly, as we get smarter and smarter on that, you know, we should find those. I mean, a stunning number of the compounds available today were synthesized by one of my heroes. His name was Alexander Shulgin, who was doing, approved research on psychedelic medicines when he learned that psychedelics were about to become Schedule I substances and become banned. He published all of his research along with a love story with him and his wife, Anna Shulgin. It's called the book's called Picol and Tikal, Phenethylamines I've Known and Loved and Tryptamines I've Known and Loved. And so a lot of what we have today is based on one chemist's underground research. So I think it's really stunning. And so I think a lot of what we have in the future, you know, could very likely, you know, be newly synthesized. Other really exciting developments are across the US, there have been decriminalization efforts that have been pushed through in a number of states that I think are massive cultural milestones because they're demonstrating that we as a society do not believe that these medicines are, these drugs or medicines are like everything else. Like they are not as dangerous and harmful and they should not be treated as such. And really exciting, Oregon just passed a measure that is essentially giving them like a 2-year period to figure out how to legalize psilocybin in the state of Oregon. And so they're figuring out how to set up facilities, supervisory requirements, licensing requirements, so that people can use psilocybin in that state in a legal context. So there are a lot of different paths here, from legalization to the FDA approval of these medicines to ketamine therapy today, to help, you know, increase access to these transformational medicines for people who really need them.
That is, I think 10 years, maybe it's 20 years, but we're going to look back and I feel like look at these things and say that they are Tic Tacs compared to alcohol, drugs that are sold in every street corner. Serial killers compared to the Tic Tacs that are
something like. There's been a ton of research. If you Google drug harm scale, there are several of them that have different axes, like harm to self, harm to others, addiction potential, that lays out different medicines on these graphs, and it's very telling.
Yeah, well, we'll put that in the show notes. A link to that in the show notes as well. Dylan, thank you so much for the generosity of time and insight around this whole new world. It is, I think, just where it's what has happened in the last 2 years. You project that out over the next 2, over the next 5, over the next 10. It's hard to think of any that's going to be as fascinating to watch impact the world in a way that, we've been waiting a couple decades for some innovation around when it comes to mental health care. So thank you so much for sharing the insight with listeners today.
Thanks, James. This is a blast.
Have a great rest of the day, buddy. And I'm really excited to see what MindBloom also becomes over the next few years. Where can people find more about you online and MindBloom online?
As a mental health care entrepreneur, I get away with not being online myself. I have no social media. I've had a bizarrely black and white phone for like a decade before it was cool. Very polarizing topic. Yeah. But you can find MindBloom at mindbloom.co.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Bad, 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 bad.